Ecclesiastes 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what good for the children of man have to do under the sun during a few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is no more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave up my heart to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Father, as we turn to this book, I ask that you will give us true wisdom from you, because though we live under the sun is not all there is. You are a God who speaks. You are a God who loves sinners like us. So teach us this morning what you will have for us in your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Recently, Coca-Cola released a series of commercials advertising their newest flavors of Diet Coke: ginger lime, feisty cherry, zesty blood orange, and twisted mango, all of which sound horrendous to me. Perhaps you'll like them. The commercial that I have seen most frequently stars an actress named Jillian Jacobs. In it, she tells us why she chooses to drink Diet Coke and why we should as well. And in her explanation, she shares with us the gospel according to Diet Coke. Jillian Jacobs says of Diet Coke, Look, here's the thing about Diet Coke. It's delicious. It makes me feel good. And then she gives us this advice. Life is short. If you want to live in a yurt it up. If you don't know what a yurt is, don't worry about it, neither do I. If you want to run a marathon, I mean, that sounds super hard, but okay. I mean, just do you, whatever that is. And if you're in a mood for a Diet Coke, have a Diet Coke. Do you hear Diet Coke's gospel? It reminds us that we have a problem that needs to be addressed. Life is short. And it often leaves us with a sense of emptiness and joylessness and loss. It leaves us needing something to fill us up a little bit, something to make us feel good. And therefore, according to Jacobs, you've got to deal with this sense of emptiness by grabbing as much enjoyment and as much satisfaction out of life as possible. And according to Diet Coke, here is how you do that. You do you. Diet Coke says you are your own happiness messiah. You can create your own happiness. You can produce your own enjoyment in this frustratingly difficult life. Diet Coke says that you are the god over your own happiness. Enjoyment in life is under your control. So, pursue as hard as you can whatever it is that will make you happy. If it's Diet Coke, great. But whatever it is, go after it. Seize the day. The gospel according to Diet Coke may sound new to you. Maybe it sounds like something only people with skinny jeans and smartphones would buy into. But as the writer of Ecclesiastes said, there is nothing new under the sun. What we see in Ecclesiastes is that the gospel according to Diet Coke has been preached for thousands of years in a myriad of different forms. And then in the opening section of Ecclesiastes, the writer comes to the conclusion that the same conclusion as did the Diet Coke commercial. Life is hard. The writer of Ecclesiastes acknowledged that same sense of emptiness and joylessness and loss when he said in that section that life is meaningless. The preacher, as he calls himself, is well acquainted with troubles of life in the world. And he wants to grab as much enjoyment out of life as he can. He's considered the fact that death is coming and life is short. And just like the gospel according to Diet Coke, the preacher wants to figure out how he can grab something to fill up that sense of emptiness. Again, we don't know exactly who the preacher was. Might have been King Solomon himself who wrote this, but most likely it was someone who was pretending that he was Solomon. Someone who was using the story of Solomon's life to teach us some important wisdom. We'll see that clearly this morning. Last week we looked at the first thing that the preacher tried to do to fill up this sense of emptiness. He was going to become a philosopher. He was going to investigate all of the uncertainties and questions that he had about life. But try as he did, he couldn't do it. The deeper he drove into life's mysteries, the more confused he became. Human wisdom wasn't the answer. Now in chapter 2, he spends a whole chapter telling us about the next thing he tried to do. And what he decided was that he was going to take control of his own happiness. This was going to be his you do you moment. He was going to live it up. He was going to grab life by the horns. He was going to create his own happiness. He tried three things. First, he did the same thing Jillian Jacobs did. He did whatever he could do to make himself feel good. That would provide some enjoyment, he thought. He tries laughter. Laughter is good medicine, right? So he went to all the comedy clubs there in the ancient Middle East. I'm sure there were lots of them. He stayed up late at night watching old reruns of Saturday Night Live. He was going to laugh to his heart's content. Then he picked up a bottle of wine. The text is a little tricky here. There's some debate as to exactly what he means. He said that he wanted to cheer his body with wine, but his heart was still guiding him with wisdom. Most likely it means that he wasn't going off the deep end, per se, with wine and getting drunk. More likely it meant that he became a wine connoisseur. He wanted to know which wines went with which meals the best so that he could try to get the most enjoyment out of this as he possibly could. At night, he had his comedy clubs and his wine tastings. And then during the day, he had his hobbies. He had all kinds of things to do to fill up the time to try to provide some enjoyment. He built beautiful houses and planted vineyards. He did all the stuff he loved to do. He then worked to find enjoyment in his wealth. And he had a lot of it. Whether this is literally Solomon or not, it's hard to say, but it is consistent with the picture that the Old Testament paints of him. Solomon was a man of incredible wealth and opulence, who built fantastic palaces and enjoyed all the stuff in the world that he could buy. In addition to all of these things, he pursued happiness in sex. He said he had many concubines. The Old Testament tells us that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. He showed no sexual restraint. He did whatever would make him happy. He said that whatever his eyes desired, he did not keep from them. But after he's done what feels good and taken life by the horns, what does he find? More emptiness. It was all vanity, he says. So then, after giving himself up to pleasure and what feels good, he turned to a slightly different version of the gospel according to Diet Coke. He still tried to create his own happiness. He still thinks he's his own happiness messiah. But instead of going off the deep end and seeking all this pleasure, he decides, as Diet Coke might say, that he's going to be a better you. He's going to be the best version of himself that he can possibly be. So he says he's going to live wisely. He admits in verse 13 that folly, or going off the deep end with 300 concubines, might not be the best and most healthy thing. Maybe it really couldn't provide all that much happiness. He says there's more gain in light than in darkness. His conclusion is that darkness didn't fill up the emptiness, but perhaps the light will. This is the self-help version of Diet Coke. The writer thinks that moral improvement, being a good person, will fill up the emptiness. So he goes to Barnes & Noble and he buys all the self-help books. Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, Richard Carlson, Tony Robbins, all of them are on his bookshelf at home. Maybe he even hires a life coach. He becomes an extremely moral person, a person that most of us would look up to. He doesn't do drugs, he doesn't watch porn, he doesn't cheat on his taxes. He's a good guy. But in the end he says, why have I been so wise? What's the point of all this? Why have I lived so morally? For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. In the end, he realizes that the one who lives as morally as possible still dies just like the fool who lives as immorally as possible. No one will remember how morally or immorally he lived. He realizes in the grand scheme of life that while morality might keep you out of jail, it doesn't ultimately profit any more than foolishness. The emptiness is still there. Life still seems meaningless. But he tries one more thing. He's got one more way to try and control his own happiness. Personal success. He throws everything into his job. He works hard. He sacrifices sleep. He gives up time with his 700 wives. Perhaps he even lets his health go. Also that someone will look at him and say, that's a successful man. That's the American dream right there. That's the kind of man people should look up to. But after he does this, he realizes again that death is coming. Everything he has spent his life building might end up being handed to a fool who comes after him. He says sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave his reward to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. In other words, he got the success. He got the money. He got everything he was looking for out of his job. But he couldn't take it with him. And the next guy to fill his shoes might be an absolute fool. That's exactly what happened to Solomon. He built this huge kingdom. He was wealthy. He succeeded in being a king. But his son Rehoboam came in, and by the end of his short little kingship, all of Israel was split in two. Everything that Solomon had worked so hard to build was gone. The point is that personal success can't make us ultimately happy. We can't get enough success to drown out the reality that death is coming. And success isn't useful in a grave. You may never have heard the phrase, "you do you," but the gospel according to Diet Coke is the default mode of every human being who has ever walked the face of this planet. Life is hard. It is frustrating. It's full of difficulty. It can leave us empty and joyless. And in those moments, it is so easy to begin to think of ourselves as the God of our own happiness. In those moments of emptiness, we often look to ourselves and think, what can I do to be happy? And often the answer is some version of, you do you. I'll do what feels good. I'll try to be a better me. I'll try to succeed in life. How is it that you try to create happiness? What is it that makes you say, if I just had this, I'd be happy. If I could just do this, I'd be happy. If I could live in that house, I'd be happy. If I could live out from under my parents' control, I'd be happy. If I was healthy, I'd be happy. If I was more successful at fill in the blank, I'd be happy. How is that working for you? Probably not well. Because when we get what we want, whatever it may be, we're disillusioned. It never seemed as good as we thought it would be. It never quite extinguishes the emptiness we feel. The preacher wants to teach us this week that nothing in the world can satisfy our emptiness. Nothing in this world can give us the happiness and enjoyment we want out of life. The preacher wants to show us that the gospel according to Diet Coke can't deliver, no matter what form we hear it in. And ultimately, he wants to cause us to long for another gospel, a better gospel, a true gospel. This morning, I want to show you four reasons from this text why this text helped us to understand why you do you can never satisfy. And in the end, I hope to show us Christ who can. First, consider with me that nothing in this world can satisfy our emptiness because good things make bad ultimate things. There's a famous American idiom that says, you can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. It means that it is impossible to produce a desired outcome from an object that has no ability to produce it. You can't squeeze blood out of a turnip because a turnip doesn't have blood. Similarly, what the preacher wants to show us is that we can't squeeze happiness or fulfillment out of the good things of this world. And the reason is because the good things of this world were not designed to give us meaning or fulfillment, just like a turnip isn't designed to give us blood. In this kind of retelling of the story of the life of Solomon, we can see that the things Solomon turned to were good things. There was nothing inherently sinful about the things Solomon looked to for happiness. There's nothing inherently sinful about laughter or wine or hobbies. There is nothing inherently sinful about wealth or sex in the right context. There is certainly nothing sinful about the desire to live a moral life or working hard at your job. These are all good things that God has given to us. And used appropriately, they can provide a sense of enjoyment. But things change rapidly when we start to see good things as ultimate things. Things change when we begin to look to good things to give us something they can't give us. I think Tim Keller summarized well in his book Counterfeit Gods what happens when we begin to make good things ultimate things. He was writing about how people can look to their spouse to fill up that sense of emptiness. He said, "If you put the weight of all your deepest hopes and longings on the person you are marrying, you're going to crush him or her with your expectations. No person, not even the best one, can give your soul all it needs. This cosmic disappointment and disillusionment is there in all of life, but we especially feel it in the things upon which we most set our hopes." When you start to set your hopes on the things of the world, even good things like spouses, you're going to start to put unrealistic expectation on the things things that they can never live up to. And here's what happens when you do that. It's what happened to Solomon. When you start to expect blood to be squeezed out of a turnip, you're going to start squeezing a little harder to get it. That's why Solomon had 300 concubines. Sex with one girl didn't fulfill him. He needed more. It's the same with us. If we look to money to make us happy, we're going to squeeze everything we can out of life to get more and more possible. If it's our job, we're never going to stop working. If it's our kids, we're going to be helicopter parents who try to control everything our kids do for our own sense of satisfaction. We think if we squeeze and squeeze, we'll eventually get something out of whatever it is that we're squeezing. But what's really going to happen is we're going to crush it. By the end of Solomon's pursuit, he can't find even the slightest bit of enjoyment in the things he formerly thought were good things. It's all become meaningless to him because none of it could live up to his expectations. That's often why people get divorced. That's why people leave good jobs. They crush a good thing with the weight of their expectations and it can't deliver, and so they go looking for something else on which to place their expectations. The Bible has a word that it frequently uses to describe what it means to treat good things like ultimate things. It's idolatry. When we look to the things of this world to satisfy us, even good things, when we expect those things to fill us up, we are putting those things in the place of God. We're worshiping the created instead of the Creator, as Paul said in Romans 1. Friends, we are created to find our fulfillment in God, not in the things of this world. We are created to find satisfaction and enjoyment in Him. The things of this world can't play God. They're not meant to. Good things make bad ultimate things. Second, and related to the first point, I want you to see that nothing in this world can satisfy your emptiness, because making good things, ultimate things, always backfires. Solomon starts out aiming for joy, aiming for pleasure, aiming for happiness. But by the end of the journey, he's totally depressed. He says he hates life. He's given his heart up to despair. Nothing will do it. Nothing will give him satisfaction. He pursued pleasure as hard as he could. He found it was all misery. Again, he's crushed these things under the weight of expectation, under the weight of his expectations. This is made clear in verse 24. There's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Usually when we hear that verse by itself, we tend to think of it as a positive thing. But in context, it's being used negatively. He's saying that in reality, if life under the sun is all there is, that this is all there is. Life is hard. You can try and find a little bit of enjoyment in drink and food and sex. But don't go overboard into folly. Don't go off the deep end. But at the same time, pursue all those things. Don't go over the deep end. But don't worry about being too moral either. None of it can really pay off. He's given up hope. He's got no answer anymore to the emptiness that he feels. All he can say is, well, true happiness isn't really possible. Just deal with it the best that you can. According to the preacher, the gospel, according to Diet Coke, is a con. The preacher says, go ahead and grab life by the horns. Go and do you. Be a better you. Work as hard as you can. Get success. Get as much enjoyment out of life as possible. You'll be miserable. If you listen to the gospel according to Diet Coke, you get exactly the opposite of what it is that you want. One of the easiest observations to make in the lives of others and in our own lives is that when we try to find happiness in the things of this world, is that as soon as we turn a good thing into an ultimate thing, try to get happiness out of it, happiness becomes instantly elusive. In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis wrote, the longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. There was something we have grasped at in the first moment of longing which just fades away in reality. I think everyone knows what I mean. The wife may be a good wife. The hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and the chemistry may have been an interesting job, but something has evaded us. The harder we work to find happiness in the world, the more happiness will evade us. The more we aim for pleasure, the less of it we find. Next, the preacher shows us that nothing in the world can satisfy our emptiness, because happiness doesn't come from us. If you've got kids or grandkids or just a kid at heart, you've probably seen the movie Trolls. It's a super fun movie. At one level, it is simply a David and Goliath story about how two little trolls save their friends from the big bad Bergens. But at its core, Trolls is a story about the gospel according to Diet Coke. It's a story about how to be happy. And what we are told over and over again throughout the course of the movie is that happiness isn't something you have to go looking for. The movie Trolls tells us that happiness is something we possess deep inside ourselves. Just like the Diet Coke commercial, Trolls tells us that we are our own happiness messiah. That we are the God in control of our own enjoyment of life. But what does the preacher say? Nothing is better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. In other words, it doesn't really work. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat? Or who can have enjoyment? This isn't the first time in Ecclesiastes that we've seen a gift attributed to God. The first time we saw it was in chapter 1, where the preacher told us that our futile attempt to answer all of life's questions comes from God. The point here is the same as it was there. God has made it impossible for us to find happiness in the things of this world. It is God
in his infinite grace and mercy who prevents good things from being ultimate things. It is God who prevents our true happiness in the things of this world. Why would God do that? For just the same reason, he prevents us from being able to answer all of life's questions. He wants to bring us to the end of ourselves. In this case, he wants to rid us of the illusion that we have the capacity within ourselves to create some kind of happiness. This is why happiness evades us. This is why we try and squeeze happiness out of stuff and it always disappoints. God wants to show us that we are dependent on him for meaning and fulfillment and happiness. Again, C.S. Lewis wrote in Mere Christianity, famous line, you've heard it before, if we find in ourselves a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. That's what the preacher ultimately wants to show us. The things of this world don't satisfy because we were made for another world. We were made for Eden. We were made for communion with God. We were made to find our satisfaction and enjoyment in Him. Of course, we don't have the power within ourselves to create happiness. It comes from God, and He gives it to us in Himself. Lastly, consider with me in all seriousness and humility that nothing in the world can satisfy our emptiness because we don't deserve it. Recently on Twitter, Diet Coke revealed one of the fundamental pillars of their gospel and tweet when they said that we should drink their new flavors of Diet Coke because you deserve something new. It is perhaps the most important assumption of Diet Coke's gospel, that humans deserve good things to happen to them, and that they primarily deserve, according to their commercials, perfect, uninterrupted happiness. And on the flip side, we don't deserve frustration, angst, uncertainty, difficulty, or anything else that might characterize unhappiness. But a few thousand years ago, the preacher investigated the beliefs and assumptions of Diet Coke's gospel, and he came to a radically different conclusion. Here it is. Apart from God, who can eat or drink or have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. What's the conclusion? Only those who please God can find happiness. Only those who please God can have that inner sense of emptiness filled. The rest of the world, the sinners, receive toil and inner angst as they cope with their inability to find anything that can please them. And very importantly, after the preacher repeats that God gives only to the one who pleases him, he says, this also is meaningless and a striving after the wind. What's he referring to? What is a striving after the wind? Trying to please God. Here he tells us the foundational reason why humans cannot create their own happiness. We can't be happy because we can't do anything that pleases God. We are sinners. We do not deserve happiness. We do not deserve fulfillment. That's why the curse was introduced to the world after the fall. Before the fall, Adam loved his work. It was fulfilling. What happened after the fall? God cursed Adam. His work would be a toil. He would sweat all the days of his life. No more fulfillment. No more ultimate joy. We don't deserve happiness. And all of us know it. All of us know it. If people really believe that they deserve to be happy, why do they continue trying to convince themselves that they deserve to be happy? If they really believe they deserve to be happy, why do they have to repeat to themselves over and over and over and try to say, I know I deserve happiness? It's not just because they're perpetually unhappy. It's because somewhere deep down in their souls, they know that happiness isn't owed to them. They may not know what it is, but they know intuitively that something is wrong with them. And therefore, happiness is not guaranteed. That's why being a better you won't bring happiness. No matter how moral you are, you can't cover up the reality that you are deeply flawed and cannot ultimately please God. And you know, what is so ironic about the fact that sinners want happiness, but cannot get it because we're sinners? What is it that's so ironic about that? What is so ironic is that what the Bible teaches us is that the foundational sin of humankind, the sin that lies beneath every other sin, is trying to find happiness outside of God. What is so ironic is that our quest to find true happiness in the world, within ourselves, and outside of God, our idolatry is the very thing that prevents us from being able to find joy. That's what happened in the Garden of Eden. The words the devil spoke to Eve were, did God really say you could not eat from any tree in the garden? But what he was really saying behind that was, is it not possible to find some enjoyment in life in this good thing God created? Beloved, you do you is not merely a clever marketing strategy. It is a repackaged version of the same lie the devil has been telling for thousands of years. The gospel, according to Diet Coke, says, do what feels good. Look within yourselves for happiness. It's meaningless. It will never happen. But the gospel, according to Jesus, speaks a better word. We sinners have always and continue to substitute things in the place of God, trying to get temporary happiness. But the gospel says that God substituted his own Son in the place of sinners to secure our eternal happiness. We don't deserve what God can give, but in Jesus we find one who did. In Jesus, we find one who never looked to the things of this world for fulfillment, but only lived to please God. Jesus never pursued fulfillment by doing what felt good. Instead, Jesus always and only found his joy in the Lord. He constantly delighted in him and loved him and worshiped him. And here's the good news. When God put Jesus on a cross as a substitute in your place, he imputed Christ's record of delighting in God to you. Through faith in Jesus and the imputation of Christ's righteousness, you are counted as having only and always delighted in God. In God's mind, never have you once looked anywhere else but to him for your greatest delight and joy. The good news of the gospel is that we don't need our own righteousness or morality. We get Christ's. And therefore, because of what Christ has done, we are pleasing to God. Do you hear the significance of that? Because of what Christ has done, you are pleasing in God's sight. Because of Christ, God is delighted in you. Because of Christ, God finds joy in you. Here's the real kicker of the gospel and the secret to true happiness. We find true happiness in life not by pursuing our own delights in the things of this world. We find true happiness when we turn from our futile attempts to gain what we cannot get, to see through faith in Jesus that God delights in us. Brothers and sisters, we don't have to be our own happiness Messiah. Jesus has come, and God is pleased with us. What are you looking to for happiness? What do you wish you had? What do you wish you didn't have? What is it you're being disillusioned by? The world says, you do you. It's a false gospel. When we aim there, we're aiming at the wrong thing. What is all of that when you are loved by God in Christ? Don't simply aim at being fulfilled. Don't even aim at happiness. That's idolatry. Aim to be known and loved by God through faith in Jesus. God can handle all of your expectations. You can get happiness out of God. When you do that, you'll begin to find that inner sense of emptiness filled by a God who loves you. And you'll be able to see the good things of this world for what they really are. Gifts to be enjoyed but not depended on. You won't be happy all the day. Life will still be hard. We'll look to substitutes more than we wish we did. That inner angst will return from time to time. After all, we're not in Eden. But hold on, brothers and sisters. We'll be there again soon. There the curse will be crushed. There will be no more substitutes. There, we will forever delight in God as He delights in us.